Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Can the Heat continue to beat the Bucks? What kind of coach will Steve Nash be? Will the Rockets threaten the Lakers? The only question left is, say it with me, you win. Hey, sports fans, Coach Nick here, and welcome to the B-Ball Breakdown Podcast. It's been a minute, but we're back. I am here with Brady Klopfer of SB Nation fame. And of the B-Ball Breakdown Podcast. So, Brady, thanks for hopping on with me.
Always my pleasure, Coach.
Awesome. Well, we're sitting here recording this on a Thursday afternoon, having just gone through, I think, two straight days of some of the most confounding basketball we've seen in a little while. Let's talk about that. We're going to talk about Steve Nash. I don't want to forget about that, but I feel like, you know what? People want to hear a little bit about what's happened in these games first. So, what's your thoughts? Let's go with the Heat-Bucks first, now that the Heat are up 2-0. What is your immediate thoughts on what that series is looking like to you?
Yeah, I mean, I've been kind of going back and forth as to whether I should be impressed with the job that the Heat are doing or disappointed in the job that the Bucks are doing. I think ultimately it's both. But, you know, whenever we podcasted before the bubble even started, we talked about some of the playoff issues that Milwaukee had last year and how we weren't particularly convinced that those issues weren't going to rear their heads again this postseason. And we're seeing a lot of the same stuff, and it's not the same team that we saw during the regular season. It feels like they are more easily game planned against. Eric Spoelstra is obviously a tremendous defensive coach. And it feels like Miami is just, their defense is attacking Milwaukee, and Milwaukee doesn't seem to have any way of solving problems and doesn't even seem to have a second option on a lot of plays. And you add that to the fact that they seem to be resting their best players for weirdly long stretches of time and putting out confounding lineups. And it doesn't look good on their end.
I agree. I've been really confused by the Budenholzer defense for a couple of years now because it's been so good, yet what I see are some real issues. Now, I think the biggest issue we've talked about ad nauseum is they will overhelp to stop the ball handler from getting to the basket. And I get it. You want to wall the paint off. Don't let them, you know, score there. But it means you're going to leave open shooters. And they do that more than anybody else does in the league. There was a rumor going on, and I've been trying to get some second spectrum data to kind of confirm this, that, you know, they were only helping off of the bad shooters. And so the volume of open shots from behind the arc were because it was, you know, bad shooters. But I haven't quite sussed that out. And certainly when you watch Miami, they don't have a lot of bad shooters. And this was going to be a thing I really had my eyes open on looking at, because what was interesting is in game one, they beat them up in the paint. They scored a ton of points in the paint. It wasn't working how they were helping off. But, you know, you had to imagine, okay, they got that one. But you had to imagine that going forward, they're going to have at least one other game where they start raining down threes. And that's what happened in game two. Outscored them by 10. And if you outscore the other team by 10 three-pointers, it almost doesn't matter what you do. Now, that's the weird thing, right? They had the game, and then it kind of almost fell apart for them at the very end, which is really interesting. So if had the Bucks stolen that, maybe we wouldn't be talking in these kind of dire terms for them.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the hot and cold of a team that relies a lot on the three-point ball, or a team that has a lot of three-point shooters. And we've seen this so many times over the last few years with Houston, where just the variance of shooting that many threes, there are some games and some stretches where it doesn't matter what the other team does, you can't be beat because you're shooting so many and you get hot. And then you go through stretches, you know, obviously Houston's notorious over 27 stretch in that game against the Warriors in the conference finals, where you just give away games no matter how well you're playing in other areas. And we kind of saw both ends of that a little bit with Miami. They kind of jumped out to a lead because they were hitting a lot, and Milwaukee was giving them those shots. And then that lead kind of started to disintegrate as the variance kind of started to swing the other way. And I think they have to feel pretty fortunate to have come away with that win. And now they're in the driver's seat.
Right. Well, I mean, it was a roller coaster because they really should have won by 10 or 12 and just, you know, put it away. They had a 6-8-point lead. It should have turned into fouls, and they would have made their free throws, and that was it. The one of the things that jumped out at me, I was kind of like hate editing the video today, going through now, you know, because the coaching, some of the coaching was really confounding. And I thought in the middle of this thing, I'm like, gosh, Spoelstra is just killing Budenholzer. It's not even close. But then things changed. So here was the one notable thing I noticed about Budenholzer that really is troubling. If you remember, they with about 17 seconds left, they had a review of an out-of-bounds play where the ball got knocked out of bounds. Clearly, it was going to be back in the Bucks' hands. But while they had the review, which was like at least three or four commercials long, they had a timeout. They were drawing up a play. And when we came back, Budenholzer wouldn't come out of the timeout. He wouldn't come out of the huddle. And he ultimately gets a delay of game call. And it wasn't even announced on the TV. Like in the play-by-play, you see it. And he's running around, and it was like for a second there, I almost thought like they had put Kyle Korver in for that. They wanted to put him in for that play. And for a second, I thought maybe they didn't tell him to check in. They totally blew that. And then they needed to call a timeout after this long timeout they had to get him in the game. It turns out you can sub in after a review of a ref. That's why I thought maybe that was the problem. But no, he could have subbed in. I just think that he whatever he tried to draw up in the first part of that timeout, he just didn't do it. He was like just confused. And you know, that just reflects poorly. I think players pick up on that. Now, in his defense, the play they finally did run after those two consecutive timeouts and whatever got him a dunk from Giannis. But I think it was much more of like Jimmy Butler beginning the process of losing his mind, which is the only way you can describe it. He kind of like wet the bed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What do you think about the play? So as they double team him after that dunk and he throws the ball back, what was going through your mind about Jimmy Butler's play in that moment?
I was confused in a way. I mean, it's kind of, it felt a little bit Jimmy Butler-ish in that, I mean, he is just this player who is capable of so much. And there are times where I feel like he is so confident in himself as being the star that he tries to do too much and it ends up hurting the rest of the team or ends up putting himself in a bad position because he's kind of focused on, I got to do this right now, and kind of forgetting that, well, this play might go on for more than 2 or 3 seconds and you might put yourself in a bad position by trying to win here. And you know, most of the time he gets away with it, but he is it like a defender who gambles a lot, who traps and doubles sometimes that are rather unconventional. And he's so good and athletic that he really gets away with it a lot of times. Now, but when it doesn't work, you're like, man, what are you doing?
Yeah. But now what about the play when he gets the ball in the corner on the out of bounds play and they trap him? And if you might remember, he throws the ball back towards Goran Dragic toward the basket, and it, you know, goes right to Brook Lopez and he scores. You played basketball in high school, right?
Yeah.
Did you ever learn in high school or maybe even before that when you're trapped in the corner there, you never throw the ball back to your own basket? Does that sound familiar?
If I had a nickel for every time my coach yelled at someone on our team to not throw it under your basket when you're trapped or falling out of bounds, I would be very rich. We were taught basically soccer style. Throw it up the sideline as far as you can.
Wow.
Do it. Throw it into the bleachers if you have to. Just don't throw it under your own basket.
Right. At least you have a chance. If it turns it over, you get a chance to play defense. But, I mean, listen, Goran Dragic froze under the basket. He should have been at least, you know, 5 feet closer to Jimmy so that he's throwing it to him, he can maybe get it before Brook Lopez does. But then nobody, there was two players in the front court that had just abandoned the guys inbounding on the Heat. No outlet for him. So I don't even care that we ended up seeing George Hill out of bounds touching the ball, like in the middle of the trap. That should have been a whistle and Heat ball again. But the other problem is they had two timeouts left. Eric Spoelstra is 4 feet away from all this is going on. He could call the timeout at any moment in there. He had 4 seconds while this was all going on where he realized, you know what? They caught us with our pants down. We were not ready for the press, which is already bad. He did not call a timeout. I mean, it was confounding, dumbfounding, just bad coaching. And it's, I hate to say it because Spoelstra has been doing a masterful job, but that's like, that's crap in the bed in a way that you almost think he should have been punished with a loss on that one to learn.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, some of these mistakes that both the coaches and players have been making, they're almost summer league-esque. Like they're just the kind of things that you expect when teams aren't really that invested in winning and they're just kind of playing. And I don't know if that's, you know, the myriad distractions that have been going on and off the court, or if it's the fact that they've still only been playing basketball for, you know, a few weeks since restarting games. I don't know what it is, and maybe it's just recency bias, but to me it feels like there are more inexcusable mistakes from both coaches and players.
You know
you would expect.
You know what it might say is it might say that the whatever pressure you might feel like being on the road and the crowd yelling and that whole thing, that might not really be the root of the pressure. The pressure might still really, really exist, and that you still are prone to make those mistakes, even though it's a quiet, you know, the background's different and it's like a lot more almost informal, right? So that's to me what happened. Like it was just like they just blanked and they didn't realize what was going on. So meanwhile, you have a couple of these calls then that we go back and forth with Middleton shooting a three. Now Dragic again. I guess the Heat fans are very loud on Twitter. They wanted to defend him and say he's straight up, but like you never should be in a situation, right? Like I'm sure maybe you even heard this in high school. Let me tell you a story about this. High school, ready? We're playing our bitter rival down the street. I mean, like, what's the rivalry? Ohio State and Michigan, like that kind of rivalry, probably. Maybe even worse. And so we've run the table in league. No one has won league undefeated forever, right? And we've done this. It's our last game on the road at this school, like our whatever. And we're up by one. And they inbound the ball. You know, no more timeouts left in the backcourt or about, you know, three-quarter court. And the guy throws it. And on his follow-through of a baseball pass, he, like, hits me in, like, the neck and the head area. And we storm the court. Out of nowhere, the referee comes running in and clears everybody off and gives him two free throws to win the game. Now, he bricked them both.
Wow.
He bricked them both. So, like, the basketball guys must have been protecting me because they knew that it was okay. But here's what I learned. I should never have been even that close to him, right? And I was. Like, I kind of did what the Dragic thing did, but, like, I didn't even put my hands up. I was just sort of in the area, you know what I mean? I was like, whatever. So that's probably the lesson that Dragic needed to learn, I suppose. You can't really put yourself in a situation. But, again, Ronnie came on the show earlier in the video, and, you know, it's a foul. I mean, what did you think about that?
Yeah, it was one of those plays where, like, as it happened live, I'm screaming at the refs for calling it. And then you see the replay, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I mean, you have to. It's so hard at the end of a game because it just doesn't sit right with you in a way. Like, you don't want the game decided like that, but you also don't want the game decided by not calling a foul that should have been called. So there's no good solution there, and ultimately it was a foul. And I think, you know, with Dragic, I think part of the issue was I don't think he was entirely aware of where he was on the court. Mm-hmm. I think he didn't realize how far past the three-point line he had gotten, because Middleton really, even though Dragic was moving forward into it, Middleton really jumped forward on that shot because he was so deep. And I think Dragic thought that they were a little closer to the three-point line and that jump shot was going to be a little bit more straight up than the kind of lean-in heave that you get from like a 28-footer from someone not named Curry or Lillard. And
you know what's interesting about that?
Move forward.
Because Ronnie made a big point about how vertical Middleton was. He wasn't really drifting much. And I think that that's true too. But I think what you're also trying to say is he was help. It wasn't his man. He's coming over from another player. Butler was there. Butler kind of, you know, did his thing, which has made him kind of take a dribble and have to pull up. And then just, you know, I'm not getting near you for a foul. So Butler actually got his head back on for that play. But Dragic lost it. And again, I think all that momentum of pulling him up, you know, he gets the left foot down, but the right foot keeps stepping forward. And that's what that, you know, it's probably 4 inches, but it's a, you know, there's a collision. And don't forget, you have to let the guy land. And that didn't, he, you know, I don't really think he let him land per se. You have to kind of go with it. But, you know, we've been saying for how many years that the refs swallow their whistles and never call those fouls, right? We see that all the time. And then here we go. So that brings us to the last play, which is Jimmy Butler. Like, you know, they didn't, by the way, this whole thing exonerates Spoelstra a little bit too, because they didn't really run. They had about 4 seconds to do something, and I really wasn't impressed with what they got. But that said, they got the ball in bounds, which is going to come up later in another game. But that was important. They at least got the ball in bounds. I have to imagine that Mark Adams, Mark Adams, is that the referee's name? Anyway, I have to imagine that he was thinking about the other play that he called, because it happens. It's the same ref, right? How is that possible? But it is. He calls a foul out of nowhere on Giannis drifting into him. What did you think about that call, which ultimately won the game for the Heat?
Felt pretty similar to me in that you don't really want to see such minimal contact decide a game. But, I mean, he's up in the air and he made contact. You can't touch a shooter when they're in the air.
I don't think
that it impacted the shot at all, but you can't touch a shooter when they're in the air. That's defense 101.
Yeah, and by the way, the light touch almost is what allowed him to kind of get his body around, so there wasn't a bigger collision with the body. So, you know, without that touch, it would have really been a big thing. Now, the interesting thing is, apparently, the rule is different now. Ronnie was trying to tell me earlier that... So let's just pretend that he didn't give him anywhere to land and he shoots the ball and the buzzer sounds and then Jimmy Butler lands all on top of Giannis, right? And he almost turns an ankle, like it's that provocative. Back in the day, that's a foul. You have to let the play complete all the way through. But apparently they changed that where if that foul and that contact happens after the buzzer, it's not a foul anymore. So Giannis was about 0.2 seconds from getting, you know, being free and clear. And that's probably part of what they were doing with the replay was, A, did he get the shot off, which he did, with like 0.2 seconds left. And then B, did that a contact occur to his ribs with the hand by Giannis before the zeros? And I think it again, barely did by a fingernail. And in theory, had it happened, you know, a 0.1 second later, then Giannis would have been, you know, they would have been overtime. So it's really fascinating how that all plays out.
How do you feel about that rule?
Oh, I think here's the interesting thing. I almost feel like the way this play played out, that I'd be okay with it if they said, oh, it's after that, you know, buzzer, it's okay. But I do feel like it should have been the foul if he lands on the guy. I mean, that's part of the play. I feel like that should be completed. The jump shot's a jump shot. So I guess I'm sort of being, riding both ends here because I'm sort of saying both, but, I feel like you should, the landing part, I don't know. Certainly if I were the guy shooting and the guy got underneath me like that, and I would want the foul no matter what happened. But it won't be one now, apparently. So what do you think?
Yeah, I don't like that they changed that. I don't like rules that allow you to kind of change the way you play the game depending on how much time is left. And so for me, like, I don't know if players will actually be able to adjust to do this, but in theory, if someone's taking a shot under a second left, you can close out just straight into them. And as long as you don't make the contact till the buzzer goes, then it's fine. And to me, you know, that's not a good defensive play because it's not a play you could make for the first 47 minutes and 59 and a half seconds. You would have to close out to the side of them and not touch them. Yeah, I kind of feel like the play has to conclude. You have to be able to defend the shot in its entirety, even if the shot yeah. goes into the buzzer.
I agree. I like that way you say that. Now, Ronnie did mention something about, like, you know, if there's a flagrant, there might be a rule that allows for that. And they might have thought about that, like a guy's just going to tackle the guy and kill him. and they might have said, okay, if it's that flagrant, then they will still call it. I don't know. We got to do some more research into that. But either way, interesting way of ending the game. I don't have a problem with the way it ended, only because to me, it felt like the Heat should have won anyway. Like, it was their game. They're causing a lot of problems for the Bucks defense, which doesn't seem to want to adjust. And I think what the greater context of this is that, you know, first of all, what we're seeing with Giannis, like the MVP award is a regular season award. The Coach of the Year is a regular season award. And I think that's a capital R, capital S, regular season. And I feel like this is what they've been working towards. And my spidey sense that tingles whenever I'm watching the regular season and then scratching my head saying, how are they the number one defensive rated team? What I'm probably really, you know, filtering that through is this is not going to work in the playoffs in a 7-game series. And we're seeing it again happen. I'm not sure what's more concerning, the defense or Giannis's lack of skill in a way. You know, he's kind of lacking skill that can be, you know, addressed by the defense. I think we're really starting to see. He even, you know, the free throws were amazing. He was 9 for 11, but then he missed the last two that were the biggest ones. It's like, what's the point of all that if you're not going to make the ones you need? And I think that they're much more cavalier about fouling him because they really don't care. Every free throw he makes is more likely he's going to miss the next one. They'll just keep doing it. So does that resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when it's an important game, you see this almost domino effect when that type of an issue crops up, because you see, like you said, the Miami defense gets to be a little bit more aggressive because they're not worried about fouling him. And that in turn makes Giannis a little bit more passive because he doesn't want to be fouled. And it just it kind of snowballs. And even though they kind of closed the gap down the stretch, the execution down the stretch in particular has just looked really poor to me from Milwaukee. And I think a lot of it is snowballing from that Miami's defense can be more aggressive and Giannis is more passive as a result. And it goes back and forth and back and forth like that.
Right. And they got rid of the hack-a-shack pretty much, where you had to foul him. The guy has the ball, he's in the play. You know, Giannis is going to be in the play. And if he's not going to be in the play, now you have your MVP who is relegated to playing like a power forward in 1993 and just screening. And then, you know, maybe gets an offensive rebound or something. It's crazy. Like, that's not what the role of an MVP is supposed to be, at least. And I don't see how that ever changes for him now without the ability to shoot the ball from outside of 8 or 9 feet. And without being able to shoot free throws, it's a real conundrum in a way that they have this, you know, unique talent who can dominate, but really doesn't translate to the playoffs. So I don't know. I like Giannis. I think he's I like the way he plays, and I think it's what is it? I mean, there's no shortage of videos I've done that have like celebrated how good he is, and especially because he was passing even more than he is now. Anyway, great kid, eager to learn, wants to work hard. But he's just limited. And, you know, the sad thing about this, I think we talked about this before, was just like the fact that he did shoot well. He did have a jump shot when he came in the league. So, you know, now before we talk about OKC and Houston in the game 7, do we want to, you know, drop a couple minutes on Steve Nash and the hiring by the Brooklyn Nets?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's break up the games with some news.
So this was a shocker, wouldn't it? Wouldn't you say?
Big time. I was rather perplexed when I got that notification on my phone. I think if I didn't have tweet notifications turned on and I just saw that scrolling, I would have assumed that it was from a fake account.
Yeah.
It's very rare in this era of the NBA to have a big move that doesn't have any smoke preceding it. Like, we never heard that Steve Nash was even interested in any coaching position, let alone that he was being targeted by the Nets. And that's just, I can't remember the last time there was a big piece of NBA news that got broke without anyone other than the people who were in the know and couldn't report on it hearing anything about it.
Right. I mean, maybe Kawhi was, you know, kept that pretty quiet. And I think there's a connection there. I think that if the Clippers had ever let it leak that Kawhi was leaning towards them or whatever, any kind of information there or any of the teams, then he would have probably said, I'm not going there. He's like, it's up to you guys to be able to keep all this, you know, quiet. I think that might have been the same thing with Nash, because it sounds like with the reporting, they've been trying to woo him for a while, for weeks or whatever that is. So that didn't come out. Like, that's pretty impressive. And it might have even been where Nash is like, I don't want any public pressure. I better not see this in the whatever. Or they, even they, he might not have even said that. It just might have been inferred, like, we better not. We don't want to put any public pressure on him to make a decision easily. So that's what happened. And, you know, it's not like he hasn't coached at all. He's been kind of popping around the league and, like, you know, jumping in and coaching. I've seen him coach at an NBA practice. And I remember walking away just being really impressed just from watching him do like a 20-minute segment on the pistol action and watching how he was teaching angles and little tiny details, which for me, for a coach, it's the detail-oriented guys that I think I respect the most. So those are the guys who really see the game and see little stuff that they can then point out. Now, obviously, it's the communication stuff, which we'll talk about in a second, too. But if you have the eye to begin with, then you're already, you know, raring to go. There's plenty of NBA coaches who are probably more big-picture guys, you know. Maybe the assistants are the ones who are going to do some of the minutiae. But I think it really helps when you have that kind of attention to detail.
Yeah, completely agree.
So, yeah. I mean, like, even just the kind of stuff where the drag screen out of pistol would be, you know, the ball screen really quickly as you transition. You know, he was just showing the big men little subtle, like, you know, if you jab this way first, your man's going to have to move that way, and then you break back to set up that screen. Now he's behind, and now you have more room. Like, I'd never seen that, and I'd seen people teach drag screens and pistol, like, you know, for years. Never had really heard that. But you know why he knows that? Well, it's because he's the guy who ran it so well, right? And everyone runs that offense now, and everyone runs pieces of that offense. So I'm really excited. I mean, you know, what do you know about him as far as, like, you know, the communication and culture that, you know, all the big touchstone words we use now?
Well, I think there are kind of two big things, or three big things, I should say, that immediately came to mind with me. The first was everything that I heard from his time with the Warriors as a consultant and occasional coach was that the players absolutely adored him, and that they got along well with him, and that they loved when he came in and they learned so much from him, and that Kevin Durant in particular got along incredibly well with him. So, you know, I don't want to speculate and say that, you know, this was a move that Durant demanded or anything like that, but I would be shocked if Durant vouching for Nash was not a huge part of this decision-making process for Brooklyn. And then the second thing that really stands out to me, the first thing that I thought of when I saw this news was a quote from Steve Kerr when Nash first came on board with the Warriors. And Kerr told reporters that Steve Kerr can't talk to Steph Curry and Kevin Durant as well as a player like Steve Nash can, because Kerr was a reserve who couldn't do much on the court. And Nash was a superstar who understood all that comes with being a superstar, and he could communicate with Curry and Durant in a way that no one else could. And I don't think he just meant from a basic management, motivation, communication standpoint. I think he also meant that minutia that you're talking about, where Nash had a larger role and he had to find those tiny areas where he could create an advantage that favored him and his team, and he had to leverage some of his weapons to create other weapons. And those are the kinds of things that players like Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving not only need to hear, but they're thirsty to hear that. They're thirsty to find someone who is on their level as a talent who can help get them to an even further level where they can manipulate defenses a little bit further. And I think that Nash, like you said, he just knows the details so well, and he knows them at a superstar individual level, which I think is a whole nother element as well into that.
Such a great point. Really great point. And I could sense that too, seeing that on the court. And, you know, the players themselves are, you know, they're human, and they have different ways of communicating and existing. And certainly, if of all people that would understand that, would be Nash, and would be able to sort of be able to explain his expectations and know what he should expect versus what he can't get out of those guys, and know that it's important that starts from the top down. So, yeah, that's going to be a really that'll help him going forward, I think. you know, as far as getting in there and eliminating any kind of awkwardness in the beginning or getting to know everybody. But I anticipate he'll put together like a great staff as well that'll help support him, just like we saw Steve Kerr did. I mean, Steve Kerr had a murderer's row of great assistants with him, and that also really helped. So that I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to happen with that, because obviously they're going to be a lot better than they were, which was a playoff team. Although they have some roster stuff to deal with, I suppose, and to some degree. And I know, by the way, Kevin Durant absolutely had say in this. You know what I mean? Not that he had final say, maybe, but he had say. Kyrie for sure had say. So let's not pretend that they weren't like completely involved. And so, so we'll see. I'm anxious to see how that's going to play out.
Yeah, it'll be fun to watch. And just one last point, like you said, I think he is going to put together a really strong cast of assistant coaches. I know Jacques Vaughn is already, you know, on as lead assistant, and that's a huge one for Brooklyn. And one of the things that's always impressed me about Nash is that he has that humility that balances his cockiness that he also has, but he has that humility where he doesn't need to be the smartest guy in the room. And that really plagues a lot of coaches who need to be the smartest guy in the room. They need their assistants to be not as smart as them in any area, and they need to just kind of be the top dog at all times. And I really think that Nash understands that he can hire assistants who know more about certain elements of the game than he does, and that is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's spend a couple minutes as we wrap up talking about OKC Houston, because that was as insane as they can come. You know, we've seen some dumb things happen. We saw Jimmy Butler throw the ball back, and that was confounding. I'm already blanking on what I saw the night before, which was really dumb. I'll think about it in a second. But we did have some interesting stuff happen in the last minute, even with OKC Houston. Now, you know, I haven't really said a lot about Russ recently, just in the last like year or two, just because it's just frustrating to have to deal with people yelling at me. But you know, I think he's revealing himself in these games, Game 6 and Game 7. You know, ill-advised shots, really troublesome stuff. I mean, he shoots a Euro off-foot lefty hook shot, left-foot jump, left-hand hook, with a shooter right in his face, with 7 seconds on the clock. Didn't even look at Harden at all to maybe give it to him. That was frustrating, but what's your overall sense, at least, of his play and how this works with Houston versus maybe even CP3?
I mean, I see the same things that you're seeing, and to be honest, I'm not surprised at all. This was an issue that I expected from the start, from the moment they traded him, and it flew under the radar, I think, a little bit during the regular season, but I think it was an issue during the regular season that there were, you know, we've talked a lot about how there's the difference between the regular season and the postseason, and one of those main differences is that in the postseason you really start to game plan for teams a little bit more, and you really start to target weaknesses and attack those weaknesses, and you don't see that as much during the regular season, but there are a few times where you do. And this is a weird game to highlight, but on Christmas, the Rockets got beat pretty handily by the Warriors, who were without Steph Curry, without Klay Thompson, might have even been without D'Angelo Russell that game, not sure. And it wasn't even that close of a game, but the Warriors, you could see they were already out of the playoff picture, and they were going hard at Houston. They were treating it like a postseason game. And what they did was they tried to take the ball out of James Harden's hands and force Russell Westbrook to just be a one-man wrecking crew. And Houston doesn't function that well when that happens. And, you know, Harden was a little bit more passive than he should have been. He wasn't having a good game. This is going back to Game 7 now. Mike D'Antoni, I don't think, did a good job of getting the ball in Harden's hands. But on the whole, Oklahoma City kind of made it clear that if someone's going to beat us, it's going to be Russell Westbrook, not James Harden. And he's just too inefficient. There's no other way around it. He's a tremendous talent. He's mesmerizing to watch. He's just too inefficient. If you put the ball in his hands and say, you go out and win this game, he can't do it at that. Without a jumper, without the proper decision-making, he's just... I don't mean to go too hard on him here, but he's just too inefficient of a player. And if you're going to target him and make him beat you instead of James Harden, I just don't see Houston having a clear path to wins.
Right. And that's a good point. Because remember, he was 9 of 20 for the game from the field, which is like, okay. But he's 1 for 8 in the fourth quarter. And again, what good is all the good stuff you're doing in the first three quarters when you can't get it done, when you need to get it done? And, you know, it's just frustrating to watch only because, you'd much rather have Harden controlling the possession at least. And then, you know, maybe either passing it off and letting somebody else get the shot that he helped create. But that also, I'm remiss because the dumb thing I mentioned earlier, I've seen some dumb things at the end of games now, wasn't necessarily Russ, but it was CP3. And I was glad to see CP3 have some success and actually play well in this game or do enough things where it seemed like they were going to be able to win this. He was 3 for 4 in the fourth quarter, but he had 2 turnovers. But the final possession was really concerning to me because this might have happened to you in high school too, but, you know, sometimes I've noticed that high school coaches don't always grasp this, and that could very well be because of the timeout situation. You can advance the ball. I don't know. But the bottom line is if you're down and there's 20 seconds left, you can't waste any time. You must get the best shot you can as quickly as you can. You need to have more possessions. You can't just dribble the ball down. Well, the Thunder get the ball back with 24 seconds to go. The shot clock's at 20, three, so it's about a second difference. They bring the ball up and they get it to Chris Paul, and he runs like 6-7 seconds down on top. You think that they would have liked to have a few more seconds at the end of that game back? Yeah. So this is weird to me that he didn't know that and, felt like he needed to take all that time and kind of get organized, whatever. And then he ultimately throws the ball almost away anyway. Like, I don't know what his plan was. It wasn't the call. It wasn't the play. Ask me how many timeouts the Thunder had left.
How many timeouts did the Thunder have, Coach?
2. So, if you're not going to go like that, and like once you got past half court and you're like, okay, we're not doing it, call timeout, run a play out of bounds. Like that would have been the other thing to do. You have 2 of them. Just, confounding. And by the way, that doesn't have to be Chris Paul. That could be Billy Donovan calling it from his spot. So, it's, again, the heat of the moment, the pressure of the moment doesn't have to be exacerbated by the crowd and being on the road and all that kind of stuff. It exists no matter where you are and no matter the setting. And I just feel like there's hardly any other explanation for it besides they know to do that. They should have known not to do what they did, and they did it anyway. And it cost them. I like the underdog story, which is probably why it seems like I'm rooting for the Thunder. I do feel like how you mentioned the Rockets are exposed, but then again, maybe it doesn't matter. They could come back in, get hot, and erase all these issues like they do normally with a three-pointer, and then suddenly the foundation is – doesn't matter what the foundation is because they can overcome that with some hot shooting.
Yeah, and it's going to make a very fascinating second-round series, especially with the way the Lakers have been playing or not playing. It's going to be fascinating to watch. I don't really know what's going to happen in that series. But just like you said, just bringing in that variance and that ability to get hot makes the second round series, I think, a lot more interesting than it would have been had the Thunder won, even though I was secretly rooting for that underdog story as well and thought it would be pretty funny if the Thunder finally made it out of the first round in the post-Kevin Durant era. And only after they got rid of Westbrook, that would have been a pretty hilarious storyline. But
oh yeah, you know what? That's true too. It would have been devastating for Russ, I think. Really,
yes.
That would have really written an epitaph on his tombstone. That would have been bad. So no one wishes that kind of bad. But then also, it's kind of bad for CP3 because it's just another example where he didn't come through, and he could have. It's troubling. But we're all human. I suspect that the Lakers, we were all saying, oh, CJ and Dame, no one can guard them on the Lakers. And look, they won 4-1. Of course, CJ had a broken back and Dame ultimately missed the game because of a injury. I think it's safe to say that Harden and Westbrook are healthy. Russ seems like he's now back. So it's a different animal altogether. And I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen to the Lakers, but I'm certainly interested. I'll watch the games. How about you?
I will definitely be watching those games and very curious to see. I'll be very curious to see what Anthony Davis does in that series, because that to me feels like you wanted to go to a team where you could win a championship. You wanted to go to a team where you could flex your muscle and prove just how good you are. Well, now you're going up against a team that doesn't play anyone within 6 inches of your height, you got to go out there and just, he has to dominate this series, in my opinion. And they can win, the Lakers can win even if he doesn't. But to me, this series might show us whether Anthony Davis is that tier one superstar or kind of the tier two superstar.
Yeah, and by the way, I kind of think that the Lakers could lose if he dominates. I think he could have a great game and doesn't necessarily propel them over the edge either. So it's a conundrum. Again, the Lakers, I keep saying this, I'm going to say it every time. Who's their fourth best player? And when you get that answer and you think, okay, is that a title-winning team? But that's the fourth best player? And I just don't know, because obviously the top two get you a long way. But you will have to find out. And the answer is Caruso, by the way, I think. And that's and by the way, I love Caruso, but I don't think he's the fourth best player on a title team.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're a team that arguably has two first best players on a championship team. And they don't have a third best player or a fourth best player or a fifth best player on a championship team, or a sixth best, I think. So it's very interesting.
All right, we'll have to find out. But Brady, thanks for doing this and letting me vent and and maybe solve some problems, some issues. And we'll figure it out. Hopefully we'll see some smarter basketball in the second round. We'll be back again next week, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, and thanks for listening, everybody. And don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, we're not a channel, we're a conversation. You in? Are you in, Brady?